We might get started. First of all, I'd like to welcome you all to what's going to be a really interesting seminar on Australia in the Asian Century. And it's focused on the white paper that the government has commissioned. And we've got a very eminent speaker, Professor Drysdale, who is on the task force that's preparing the white paper. He said to make this introduction very short, so I won't read through his biography except to mention that he is basically extremely eminent in his field, and I'm sure you all know all of his many achievements. He's going to talk for somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes. There's a lot to get through, and he's leaving a lot of time for questions at the end. So, without further ado, I'll hand over to Professor Drysdale.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here again after quite a long time, I might say, and to talk with you about this subject, which is not hot off the press. It's still hot in the press, I'm afraid. The white paper won't be out for some weeks yet. There's still a process to be gone through, and the timing of it, of course, depends on other political events, as the senator here will know, which put some of the best laid plans to rest. But it's certainly well in process. And what I want to talk to you is about some of the issues that arise in the conduct of the whole exercise, but also some of the substantial issues that will be inevitably a focus of the white paper itself. Of course, what's going on in Asia is big. And we didn't really realise how big it was until quite recently at a national level. And I think the Prime Minister's commissioning the white paper from September last year really kind of focused attention on that in a big way. I don't think we're unique as a country in doing this. I think we've got to the task more rapidly than many other countries. And as I travel around the region, as I do, and talk to political leaders and others in the region, they all say to me how wonderful it is that Australia is undertaking this exercise. They have an intense interest in it, but they wish they were doing something like this themselves. So I think we are early off the mark, but somebody like me, who's a critic of sorts by profession and trade, it's an exercise that could have come sooner, but it's great that it's come now. Could have come sooner, I can tell you, about 6 or 7 years ago, I was doing a report as a part of a big report on the emerging economies in Asia for the Asian Development Bank. And in that report, the exercise, this was before the global financial crisis, and the exercise I did there really put it up to the bank that we shouldn't be focusing, as frankly the main part of their effort was focusing on developments within the region. We should be focusing really rather on how the region was impacting and going to impact on the global economy and the global polity, and that should be the focus, because that's where the big policy challenges lay, particularly in how Asia should be relating to the major established centres of economic and political power and conducting itself in global forums in a way which supported the system which had provided the anchor for their growth and successful engagement in the international economy and polity. That element of their report, frankly, was sidelined in the final wash-up. So people didn't really understand on the eve, a year or so before the global financial crisis, that a year or two later, Asia would be dragged, some would say kicking and screaming, into global governance. That, of course, via the process of the crisis reshaping global governance through the formation of the G20, with the six key Asian participants, including Australia in that process, now important players in managing the global economic and, I should say, political system. The Asian century is here. Already Asia's income and trade shares account for basically a third of world output and more than that of world trade. The middle class in Asia has grown spectacularly. There are something like a quarter of a billion people who are classified on OECD measures as members of the middle class in Asia, bringing with them consumption patterns, demand domestically and internationally that draws the rest of the world into Asia in various ways. And rates of growth, of course, are still, through the financial crisis, far in excess of the rates of growth even the better performing OECD countries, and look set to remain there for some time to come. And the impact on the world and the shape of global interests and the management of the global system has been palpable. So there's a particular interest in Australia in this and what's happened there, although this relates to every part of the world, the United States, to Europe, as you know, and to Latin America, wherever, Africa, importantly also. But the impact on Australia is intense because there are two things that we know about international economics confidently. International Economics 101 tells us that when you have big lumps of growth in output near you, that's going to affect the interaction you have with those big lumps of growth in output. And for Australia, that's happened in the post-war period, first with Japan and so on. It's been happening consistently and more rapidly recently through the emergence of China. The second thing International Economics 101 tells you is that proximity matters. Being close to this matters. And our geography makes us close to this. And in addition, there's a third thing that matters, of course, is the structure of your resource endowments, international capacities and so on. And in the Australian case, we're uniquely complementary to the Asian economies. We provide over 50% of Northeast Asia's strategic raw material supplies, close to a quarter of Japan alone's energy requirements, bigger than all of Saudi Arabia. So we're important to Asia as Asia is important to us. But this is not just an Australian story. This is a story which impacts on the region and the world, as I explained before. So this is the context in which the Asian Century White Paper process was entered, in which the Prime Minister in September last year in Melbourne there called or commissioned an Asian Century White Paper, which was going to look at the implications of this big event for the whole structure of Australian policy making, and indeed beyond policy making per se, look at the impact of this more broadly on Australian society and the polity. How that happened, I'm still trying to work out exactly, but certainly it meant that somewhere in this town, alongside the Prime Minister providing good advice, were a bunch of visionary people who saw that this was the time to undertake an exercise like this. They saw it in a way that was a bit unusual, and I want to explain that a bit because it relates to how this thing has been set up and how the instruments for its delivery have been put in place and what the objectives of the whole exercise finally are as I see them. I won't vouch for everybody in the process, including members of Cabinet who are guiding the process forward very closely. But as I see it, this conception of the thing was there from the beginning. So getting that right from the beginning is really important part of whether or not this exercise is going to be valuable and successful down the track. And I think basically that was got right from the beginning. The Prime Minister's announcement set the context. That context included structuring the exercises in a way which was a bit unusual from the viewpoint of undertaking the writing of a white paper. A white paper, as you all know, is a government paper on some aspect of policy that government owns in some way or other. And that's normally delivered by the officials in the relevant area of government policy, defence white paper, defence people and so on, foreign policy white paper, foreign policy people, Asian Century white paper, well, by the whole of government, and reaching out beyond government, to the community more broadly, all the stakeholders that are affected by the big changes that are taking place in our region. That informed the organisation of the effort, and in particular the setting up of the task force and the advisory committee and the way in which the advisory committee related to government. The task force was drawn from across government, or key agencies of government affected directly by developments in our regional economy that have a particular importance to Australia. 20 super smart people who are working intensively on the grunt work of bringing all the information and together and writing the white paper. An advisory committee which includes the chair, Ken Henry, of course, and three officials, senior officials from three key departments. Foreign Affairs, obviously, Heather Smith, the DepSec there, Gordon DeBrow, the DepSec in PM&C, and David Ruin, the DepSec in Treasury. And alongside those three, and with Ken as the chair, three outsiders, including myself, Catherine Livingston, who's the chair of Telstra, got a wide experience in science, research and business, and John Denton, who is CEO of Coors, Westgarth and Chambers in Melbourne, which is Australia-wide, but he's based in Melbourne, and he's also chair of the International Committee of the Business Council of Australia, so he brings both business and a broader perspective to it, because he had a career, actually, that also spanned a time in foreign affairs. So that is a bit unusual for a white paper, having a guiding committee structured in that way, having the outsiders on it. But even more unusual, I suppose, was the fact that the external members of the committee, myself, Catherine and John, have also been made members of a subcommittee of cabinet, including a range of ministers, who meet regularly through this process for consultations on the direction and so on and development of the white paper with us, with the others in the room, but us as members of committee. And that is unusual. And so far as I know, somebody here with better knowledge and research background might correct me on this, on Australian parliamentary process and procedure. But I think that is unique in the history of Australian Federation to have a committee structured in this way. It's not unique in Australia. It's been done in some of the states, and it's been done in South Australia and other states, but it is unique in the federal system. And why was it done in this way? I think it's really important to understand this, because the scale of the task involved stretches well beyond government. I think that's the first thing to recognise. Whether many people understood this at the beginning, I don't know, frankly. When I was invited into the process, I'm going to tell you a story about it, which I didn't have a conception of, frankly, at the time when I was invited into the process. But it was kind of intuitive. It was there, but I certainly couldn't have articulated in the way in which I'm going to articulate it to you now. And it comprehended the idea of extensive national consultations in the process of producing the white paper. We've consulted with all levels of government in Australia. We've consulted with business extensively, all arms of business or organisations and so on. I mean, we haven't consulted with every single influential business person in Australia, but we've covered a lot. We've consulted with the educational institutions, NGOs, a whole range of people who have an interest in and a stake in these things. The participation and interest, of course, has been huge. And I'll come back to that in a moment, because I want to underline that in a moment. It's been reflected, of course, in the submissions. Not only the submissions on paper or electronically to the White Paper Task Force, but also the submissions that have come independently of that process. There are over 300 or so submissions, fairly well formulated submissions on paper or electronically to the Task Force, with many other submissions apart from those. And the consultations have involved that kind of approach to the consultation, inviting contributions both verbally and on paper. So it's been a large process. The interest has been intense, and the expectations for the process out there in the community, I tell you, are very high. I think that's what's so encouraging to somebody like myself, who's been in the business of looking and working on Asia for 50 years or so now, I hesitate to say, but that's the truth. There's a sense out there in the community of people in all these sectors that I mentioned seeing that, we're a part of a big process that's taking place. Two, that we need nationally to focus on that in a way that we haven't before. We've done it. We've put a lot of investment into this in various ways over time. But the scale and speed of change demands something more, and there's a sense of understanding of that and expectation about the process that is out there. And there's an understanding of the exceptional character of the process and the opportunity to engage in that. If this thing is going to be successful in its impact on setting policy direction, then we'll have to engage now, we'll have to continue to engage, because as I have made clear publicly and privately from the beginning of the process, there's no way in the world that a white paper commissioned for this purpose can wrap up a bundle of discrete policy recommendations now and announce them whenever we announce them in a month or 2 months' time and say that's it. Much more importantly is the process of setting directions in policy development and objectives, which will take quite a long time to achieve and to persuade people that these directions are the ones in which we should move, and there should be an explicit process of engagement beyond the delivery of the paper itself. That should be a really important and explicit part of the argument and the narrative in the white paper. These things have to take into account not only the expectation of opportunity from the Asian century, and even conservative judgments about that, I think, deliver an Asia that certainly won't be less important than it is now, and most probably will be very much more important than it is now. Having a share in world output, as the ADB now predicts, a few years after it refused to think about this issue, a share in world output of 52%, probably, not 30 or 30-odd percent that it is now, so really very big part of the world, and a big part of our world in particular. And it has to attend to considerations of the shift in not only world economic power, because world economic power inevitably brings with it an adjustment in political power, as Hugh White has made clear in his analysis and made people a little bit anxious about. They shouldn't be anxious, because they should confront the analytics of this clearly and then work out what to do about it. And that's the great service he's done, even if he hasn't produced an answer to the problem. He's done a great service to the Australian community and the international community more broadly in focusing on what choices we have to manage down the track in respect of the shift of both economic and political power. So this is the task that the White Paper task force faces, the committee faces, and ultimately the government has responsibility for delivering on through the White Paper process. What are the broad priorities? What needs to be done at home, of course, is the first stop. When Ross Garnaut did the Asian Ascendancy report, it wasn't a white paper, report to the Hawke government in 1989, that did an exercise on the first phase of this development in Asia, around Japan and Northeast Asia, Taiwan, Korea, and so on. And the most important conclusion of that report was, we dealt only effectively with what was going on in Northeast Asia if we sorted out the mess of policies at home. If we sorted out, we got policy settings right at home. And the same applies, of course, today. It's not only economic policy. You've got to get economic policy set right to take advantage of the opportunities and attend to the risks associated with the growth of the Asian economy and the polity. But we're also going to get social policy settings right, because a resilient and vibrant and confident society dealing in a confident way with developments in the region on the scale that we've already had and we will have down the track requires a confidence in your society, a coherence in your society to do that with equanimity. Economic policy and social policy settings and the scale of impact on Australia demand a comprehensive look at all of those things that are, in a sense, current verities in the policy approach in Australia on all these fronts, and areas in which there are still deficiencies, and there are many in the regulatory area and so on that we struggle to work on. You know, let me illustrate this in the proximate territory of thinking about the Asian century. If you're thinking about education policy in Australia, there's a whole lot of things that you perhaps want to put in train in order to prepare effectively for building the capacities necessarily in our community at the education level, right from primary school up to university education, to do a good job at that. But that's a task that involves, you know, if you're sitting in PM&C over there and in the Prime Minister's office or wherever, involves negotiation with a whole lot of stakeholders in the education community, but importantly, levels of government through the COAG process. That is a long and painful process in some ways. Any reform of that kind will require that kind of engagement and delivery over time, not at any one point in time. So even on that area, you've got setting the directions is half the battle. And then there are the international initiatives. And the starting point in that for me, and I keep saying this, I hope it's listened to from time to time, but you'll see, is that the Asian century was delivered in a global setting under a global regime, you know, not by any sort of regional or bilateral set of arrangements in Asia. When in the post-war period we set up the great post-war institutions like the WTO, as it's called now, the GATT, IMF and all that, it's that framework that gave the Japanese and the Chinese latterly, for example, the confidence to integrate into the international economy, open up to the international economy, if you like, in a way that ensured that they, with their resource-deficient economic base, could achieve high rates of economic development and industrialization in the way that they have. And of course, that in turn had its impact on our good fortune through the opportunities it gave for us to build a prosperous and high-performing economy across many sectors, but particularly across the resource sector, has done pretty well out of all that and continues to do pretty well and will do even better down the track. So a focus, interestingly, on the Asian century encourages a focus on getting global policy involvement right. And importantly, of course, the G20 is the new area of policy delivery, a new instrument of policy delivery that we have to attend to in that context. But there are many other areas of policy delivery in that global framework, the financial institutions through the fragilities of the global financial crisis and a raft of issues that have to be got right there. So that's the first, that's the starting point in this process. But of course, that involves our participation, but it also involves our Asian partners' participation in the G20 and other global processes. And working with them in that context becomes really important. In a sense, you know, Asia was dragged kicking and screaming into its role in the global economy and the global polity through the global financial crisis and the establishment of the G20 process. The six Asian members, including Australia, are now important players in there and have been working intensively to deliver something unique and valuable to the development of the international response, not only to the crisis itself, but also to longer-term recovery and sustainable growth beyond the crisis, which is even more important. There's that, and working in that context, globally, but with a regional base. And then there are the regional arrangements we have in place, the APEC arrangement, the East Asian Summit arrangement, always in a state of evolution and that we have to take maximum advantage of in connecting with our sort of broader foreign economic and global agendas, but also, of course, in delivering things more approximately to home. And then there are the bilateral partnerships. And there are obviously some big new bilateral partnerships that have emerged since my youth as being really rather important. In my day, of course, it was Japan. I first went to Japan as a graduate student. I was one of the first two graduate students to go to Japan after the Second World War and work in Japan on the Japanese economy. The challenges that we faced in managing that, it was not easy for our Prime Minister today, Robert Menzies, to actually embrace Japan through the agreement of 1957. All the things attendant to that was seen as rather strange. You can't imagine it now. For me to commit myself to going to Japan in the early 1960s and do that work. And we have a similar sorts of uncertainties about where we're going in the space that we have to deal with now, which incorporates not only China, but India and Indonesia in a big way. And those economies in particular, and those relationships in particular, I think are big for more comprehensive arrangements within which we can conduct our dealings with them. Alongside the established importance of Japan, Korea, and the ASEAN group of countries. And there is the question of the shared security interests we have in the region. And that, of course, plays into the debate about how we manage the adjustment of economic and military power that's inevitably taking place with the growth already has taken place and inevitably will take place more intensely down the track with the shift of economic power from North America towards Asia. So these things are not going to be delivered on if we don't build up the national assets that we need and the capabilities in business, in education and the public sector that we need to do the work on them. We've got a lot of national assets. We've got the assets that we've invested in the past in Asian capabilities and Asian-related capabilities. But again, as somebody who's by trade responsibility a critic of this, I'd have to say that there are gaps there, significant gaps, to serve the tasks that we've had thus far, let alone to serve the tasks that we'll have in the future, have to be fixed and have to be filled. We've got assets of another kind that are underutilised in many ways. We've got a large proportion of our population is overseas born. A third of that population that was overseas born was born in Asia. And those Australians born in Asia, of course, are really playing an important role in the connection between Australia and Asia and what's going on in Asia, but they can be mobilised in various ways, even more intensively, to assist in that role. So, one of the lessons that I draw from all this process thus far in the next few minutes, first of all, the stakeholder and community response has been incredibly positive. You know, if you went 20 years back, 15 years back, I couldn't guarantee you that if we'd done an exercise like this then, that you would have had the same response out in the community. The community understands the importance of it in a way that it didn't then. And the conception of Asia in Australian thinking has changed and how we relate to it. In a way that certainly 20 years ago wouldn't have been routinely the case. Commonly, Australians in leadership and influential roles in whatever sector see ourselves as part of a process in Asia. They don't see us as outside that process. They talk about being part of what's going on in Asia. Even business institutions that I would have described 20 years ago or even 10 years ago has been intensely conservative in that respect, very parochial. Of course, their bread and butter was buttered on a system here that cosseted them in various ways in the past. They don't see it that way. We've gone through that process through the reforms that have happened before, especially in business, I think. But it's more broadly in the community in the way in which you consult in level, at different levels of government, and more broadly in the community, and obviously in the educational institutions. So that's a big lesson. Recognition of the importance and ambition of the white paper study is a part of that process. And there's clearly the beginnings of a national conversation that the white paper, the ink, hasn't begun to spin on the white paper yet, but the preliminaries are there. It's certainly not done and dusted. But already things are happening that have been catalysed by the white paper process. A number of state governments have initiated their own white paper processes. The Tasmanians have done that. The Northern Territory people have done that. I believe Victoria is doing that. Western Australia is doing that, and so on. So it's all spun off the bat of the national initiative in this respect. That's one aspect of it. But institutions also that have to be involved are starting themselves to reposition in this. Business is repositioning this. In a couple of weeks' time, Mike Smith, CEO of ANZ Bank, will deliver a report which has been done in concert with AsiaLink down there in Melbourne and a number of other people around the country on workplace education and developing the capabilities in the workplace to deal with the Asian century interests. And in the universities, it's already starting to happen. We've got the biggest collection of assets over here at the ANU on work on Asia anywhere in the English-speaking world, any institution anywhere in the English-speaking world. You know, bigger than Columbia University in America or Yale or Harvard, where I work from time to time. And bigger, actually, than most collections of people working on Asia as a whole in many non-English, most non-English-speaking universities, I might say. But if I could honestly stand here and say to you that all those assets are being most productively and efficiently deployed towards the national purpose that I've defined as part of the interest in the Asia Century White Paper, I'd have to say to you honestly that that's not the case. But the Asian Century White Paper catalyses that institution, institutions around the country, to actually do something different, to actually lift the game in various ways. And that's already happened before the ink has dried on the white paper. So that's a pretty important thing. And it implies the beginning of a national conversation about our interests in the Asian century in a way that's much more structured, much more purposeful than we've had in the past. So let me try and conclude by saying that, as I said at the beginning, the white paper cannot pretend to produce all the solutions to the issues that are raised by the developments in Asia that we now read about daily in the press. But what it can do is set policy directions for the future and hopefully in a way that engages all sides of politics. It's not just a narrowly government of the day exercise, especially if the government, if the white papers be credible in engaging governments down the track, governments of its own colour and governments of a different colour down the track. It will have to reach out to do that in a way that is credible and effective. Because, you know, you take any one of those policy areas I mentioned, at the domestic level, some things can be done quickly and they should be announced and they can be announced. But you take any of the international aspects of the policy that I mentioned there on the G20 front, on the regional architecture front, work with the Asian partners in the G20 process and so on, all of those require a lot of work. It's rather in international diplomacy, an exercise like you engage in when you do what we call one-and-a-half track or second-track diplomacy, which actually recognises that governments actually can't deliver policies with the objectives that you want to achieve. You have to actually engage a whole lot of people outside government to work with you in doing that, and to work with other governments if it's international, and talk all that through and work out what the hairs are on getting where you want to, given where they want to get. And that's a very important part of this process too. It's a part of the process nationally. You're talking with institutions, you're talking with levels of government, you're talking with business and so on, and business has its own resources and agenda, and motivating that resource base and agenda of this purpose is a very important part of the objective. And it's true, obviously, of working with the institutions here in Australia. So setting those directions right in a way that engages the community broadly is going to be the difference between triumph and failure in this Asian Century White Paper process. So engaging business and community leaders in policy development will be, and is already has been, an important part of the exercise, and it will be an important part of the exercise beyond government in the shared task which is required in changing mindsets and priorities in Australia to deliver on the opportunities and managing the risks of the Asian century. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Drysdale. So now we can take questions. So.
Australia's foreign investment policy is founded in the economic nationalism of the 1970s. Do you think we need a national conversation about that?
Unquestionably. That institution was... I think we have to look at the effectiveness with which all our established and in the past productive institutions work. And that institution is one that is in that category. It doesn't mean that you'd want to... I think there's a consensus, basically, in this country on policy towards foreign investment, broadly. Nobody would want to disturb that consensus. But there are questions around the edges of that, at the margins of that, that have been raised that might disturb the underlying consensus if we don't attend to them, we don't deal with them. And so I think that's an area in which there will be further, not only conversation, but there will be further examination, inquiry and so on, and policy development. So I think that's one area, and I'd be kidding you if I'm involved in it. Basically, I'm at the core of organising a large international project, for example, on Chinese overseas direct investment, its impact in Australia, but its impact globally. And we've got the best people in the world involved in that project, from the United States, from Europe, from Africa, and from Latin America and so on. And that project will help to inform public discussion of the management of this big new element, the largest new element in overseas direct investment globally. So anybody who is sensible wouldn't want to switch off that conversation. So, yes, it will be a part of the conversation, I would think. It doesn't mean we're going to disturb the fundamental institutional framework for managing these things in Australia, which I think, and especially since I was involved in sort of arguing for it when it was set up originally in the 1970s, believe it or not, you wouldn't want to disturb that, would you? So but keeping that in place, but getting... the adjustments that you might need to get in place to deal with a new set of circumstances makes good sense in this area as it does in other areas.
Yeah. Professor, you made a reference to Hugh White, and going back to the 2009 Defence White Paper, there's been a conversation going on in Australia and elsewhere, with the main theme of it being the idea that at some stage in the future, a couple of decades perhaps, we will be at war with China alongside the United States. Now, it's a rather bleak view, and it's a view through perhaps the periscope of an attack helicopter rather than the sort of erudite views of an international expert on economics. Do you share the view that the strategic military situation is likely to be that bleak? Is it some sort of confrontation with China, perhaps triggered by something in the South China Sea or wherever it might be, as dangerous and likely as various commentators have painted it? And, the second part of this was the Strategic Policy Institute is putting some material out shortly in which they're suggesting that the process, the white paper process, the Asia white paper, should be more closely linked to the 2013 defence white paper to get a broader view of how issues should be handled.
Yeah, well, just let me say at the beginning, I think this is an important interest and questions pertinent, but the starting point of the question I think is stated a little bit extremely. I think that the careful discussion of these issues in the public domain, including that promoted or prompted by Hugh's contribution, paints a scenario that is anyway so stark as the one you put as the initial proposition. But that aside, you've got the right point. Yeah. So I just want to make that qualification to start with. But then, I want to address this as frankly and honestly as I possibly can, given where we're all at. I think I don't share the view that it's inevitable that there's a conflict between China and the United States. I was here in this house yesterday with a top official from China, who's a top aide to incoming President Xi in China, meeting with the foreign minister and meeting with the treasurer, and he doesn't share that view. And they're actively working in a way which would avoid that kind of competition, that kind of conflict between the United States and China. Now, that doesn't mean to say that you can rule out the risks of such a conflict happening by accident or even by sub-design. And you have to consider those scenarios. So that's what defence planning is all about. Certainly they're not at the top of the head, the space in my head about thinking about the future political regime in Asia and the Pacific. I think everybody's feeling their way in this process. I'm in the process of writing something about this at the moment, so you'll sort of have a more articulate vision of this in a week or so's time. But, you know, the Americans are thinking this through and feeling their way forward on it in their characteristic, thorough and careful way. And they haven't articulated a complete strategic view which comprehends all the nuances of their new strategy in Asia and the Pacific. The pivot towards Asia doesn't comprehend the nuances of American strategy towards Asia and the Pacific at this stage. And so, you know, we're all going to be feeling our way. I see the next sort of half a dozen years, 10 years, has been particularly important in making sure that happens, and making sure in particular we don't sit on the sidelines of that process because we have a peculiarly important role to play in it. But I don't see the outcome as necessarily being anyways set in stone in the way that some of the protagonists in this argument suggest. The second point I want to make is that I do see there having been an excessive bifurcation of the discussion of economic and political military security interests, if you like, in Australia. But it's historically, maybe, but peculiarly in recent times, which is unhealthy from both sides around. Because the economic and the political and military security things intersect with each other powerfully. They can't be dealt with separately. This white paper process precluded us from making pronouncements on defence policy appropriately. It should have done that. But it didn't preclude us from thinking about the interaction between political security and economic interests. You know, I told you the story about how important the resource trade relationship was between Australia and Northeast Asia. That is a critical element in Northeast Asian security and our security. The political trade there, or the security trade there, is between through our reliable involvement in the international market in these things and reliable supply of these commodities to our partners in Northeast Asia. It delivers to them a measure of economic security they wouldn't easily otherwise have. And vice versa, you know, their participation in this process in the way that is congenial to us in this open market system delivers us a measure of political security which we would not otherwise have had. Disturb that in any fundamental way and you need a large number of aircraft carriers to deal with it. And that's not well understood in the security community here. It's not well understood in the political process in Washington, where it should be understood. And it's not well understood even at the leadership level across the spectrum here in Australia, in all sectors of the community. It's more more clearly understood in the business community than anywhere else. Certainly, if you talk to business leaders in Japan, they understand it very clearly. In Korea, they understand it very clearly. And the Chinese are coming to terms with that sort of relationship with Australia, and are now sort of seeking to explore the confirmation of that, if you like. So I answered your question rather long-windedly, but I hope the points I made in the way to the answer to your question sort of cover the points that you would want me to cover.
They did, thanks.
Yeah.
I've got a question about wondering whether you would elaborate on one of the comments that you made earlier in your remarks. You talked about how we've got national assets,
yep.
But there are significant gaps,
yep.
To serve the tasks thus far, let alone the tasks of
yep.
the future.
Yep.
And I'm just curious if you can expand on what some of those gaps might be in your view at the moment.
Well, we call them Asia capabilities. It's Asia literacy, broadly defined, being plugged in, able to respond and understand what's going in Asia. You know, I'm now rung up every day from analysts and so on in the market wanting to know what the latest development is in the Chinese wholesale production index and so on. That information is there in a desiccated form, but we haven't a depth of capacity in this country to be right on top of that, right ahead of it when we need it, really. And being so, we'll avoid a lot of investment mistakes and avoid a lot of gyrations that needn't happen otherwise, for example. So out there in the business community, that's what Mike Smith's study working group's all about, in the universities even. Let me be, explicit about, concrete about this. You know, you take our own university here, my own university here at the ANU, and the way in which we relate to these developments. There's so many more things we could do to actually lift the capacities of our own students who are playing this game. We could, for example, and we're committed to this, make it routine, basically compulsory, for our own students who are pretending to acquire Asian capabilities, spend a year in Asia improving greatly, I might say, those capabilities. We were the leaders introducing the Year Abroad program here at the ANU, which started with Japan in the 1970s. But does it cover all our students, even the Japan front? No, it doesn't. But it will. It will from now on. And that energy has been driven, importantly, by the process that we've been engaged on here. And so they're only some of the things. And you take that back further. Anyone who's ever studied a foreign language or tried to work in a foreign setting, even at a distance, even at arm's length, will know that opening the door to doing that comes at a pretty early stage if it's going to be successfully done. You can sort of fly people into the task, but really it's very important to start early. So, we're talking about fundamental changes in the education system here that we haven't got in place. We operate as if we're a mono... And there's only one other country in the world that does this, and they basically have a bit of luxury in doing this, which is the United States. We operate like a monolingual, monocultural country in terms of our policy settings for education in this country. And we benchmark against standards that are now relevant. We should be benchmarking more against standards that are Asian standards, because some of them are the best in the world. So, there are gaps, and that's only a few of them.
I'll try another one if I can.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
I'm curious about, you talked about the structure of the group that's doing the paper. I wonder about your thoughts on the structure that should be in place after the paper comes out.
Okay, yeah.
How do you set that up to actually get results?
Yeah. Well, Let me just say a little bit more about the structure of the paper. I mean, I didn't make this as explicit as I might have before, which is, the reason why it's sort of this exercise reaches out and brings in people from the outside to the process is because of what the ultimate objective actually has to be in terms of success, as I said. So that structure, the instruments we're using to serve this policy set of policy objectives, it's a grand strategic objective, if you like, suit the task. The worst thing you can do, as we say in economics, is get the wrong instrument for the wrong policy. Yeah. So I think that's been got right. But you're right. The task beyond that is, how do you get those things right? And it's not going to be easy. And there'll be an iteration. I don't think we'll get that. I mean, it's very difficult to get that entirely right. And that's part of what should go on. There should be iteration and development of this. But one of the things I think that's got to take place is that we've got to, at the sort of highest political level, endorse an ongoing conversation in Australia that brings people in from outside Australia to that conversation in a way that we haven't brought them in the past. That can be done in a whole variety of ways, and there'll be different views about what the best way to do that is. But whatever way it's done, it's got to systematically involve the stakeholders in their own initiatives and efforts, because the government can't deliver on what it hopes to deliver here alone. And that's got to be driven by incentivizing people, as the business management people say, rather than actually ordering them to do. They can't order anybody to do anything in this area at all. So providing opportunity for those stakeholders to be heard and to focus to develop initiatives, I think, is half the task. And so if something is set up in that way that gives high-level political endorsement and provides that space in a way that is not quite there at the moment, everybody gets up and jumps up and down from time to time when they see a problem here or a problem there, but it's not regarded as part of the national task. It should be regarded as routinely a part of the national task.
I guess I just wanted to ask about one part of that conversation. Is it also about the government engaging with business and the community on perceived risk in Asia? Because I think one of the big barriers to both bigger business and community engagement is the popular perception of sometimes of Asia being a risky place, either to do business or to travel. So is that part of that conversation? Because the government produces a lot of analysis internally, I think, on risks in Asia and opportunities, but often that tends to stay within government, and it doesn't often it isn't often used for outreach.
Yep. Well, I think that is clearly part of the task here and interest here. I should just say that I think one of the things that the task force came to understand very quickly was that these things aren't the problem of the community out there, the business community out there, or the institutions out there. They're within ourselves, importantly within ourselves. If you look, I emphasise they're developing appropriate public sector capabilities. If you look at what we do in the public sector to encourage Asia literate capability, I don't mean this in a narrow linguistic sense, I mean it in a broad sense, it's pretty limited. And so that will be one of the areas of action that can be prosecuted fairly quickly, because it's within the control of government to do something about that, even though there are opportunity costs in the redeployment of resources. But as a part of normal human resource development, within the public sector, you can do something about that. And you can do something about that in other sectors, of course, in the same way. So, I think that's a bit of a side response to your main point, but I think you're absolutely right. That's got to be part of the conversation, but more importantly and proximately, it's got to be part of the policy direction setting. You might set the direction of policy in a way that requires further conversation, and you might require further conversation around that in setting or refining policy direction, but I think importantly, what you have in mind has got to be part of policy direction setting. Yes?
Was there any part in the discussions that you had with everyone, where it was talked about how Asia sees Australia and what Australia's profile is, and whether there are things we need to do to change any perceptions that are there.
Yeah, that has been a part of the consultation and, of course, the research and information gathering. Not been an overly extensive part of it, but it's been an important part of it. And indeed, of course, many of the committee members individually sort of travelled to Asia and, as they've been involved in this process, are endorsed with the opportunity to seek views on this around Asia, and we have done that. But more importantly, the principals in the process, Ken and Megan Quinn, who's heading up the task force, and others have purposefully travelled around the region to take advice on all of those things, and as well as other aspects of policy development in the white paper. So it is an interest. But I think you will understand from what I said earlier that the most important thing in that is not to worry too much about what people think about you, but whether you're comfortable in how you think about yourselves. And that's true individually or personally as well as it is nationally. So insofar as we meet that test, we'll be meeting the test that intelligent Asian players will apply to us too. Thank you very much.
It just remains for me to, on behalf of the Parliamentary Library, to thank Professor Drysdale and to thank you for being a really good audience, for asking questions I would have asked myself if you hadn't asked them. So thank you all very much, and perhaps we could all thank Professor Drysdale again.
Left it in one of the initiatives.